Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free.
So now, ladies and gentlemen, it is start time. Are you ready for start time?
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're reviewing new albums by rapper Little Sims and gothic blues artist Adia Victoria. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. But first, we're talking with filmmaker Dream Hampton about her docuseries Surviving R. Kelly in light of the historic conviction of that R&B superstar. A trigger warning to our listeners, Dream Hampton and I are going to talk about our involvement in a story that involves historic levels of sexual abuse. Please take care of yourself and know that there are resources out there.
So big news this week, New York jury on Monday found R&B singer R. Kelly guilty on all charges in his trial in racketeering and sex trafficking charges. We have the two journalists in our midst who I think did more than anyone to make sure that this the outcome that occurred on Monday did in fact occur. My colleague Jim DeRogatis, who broke the story more than 20 years ago in print, and Dream Hampton, the great American filmmaker, producer, and writer, whose work includes that 2019 Lifetime documentary series Surviving R. Kelly, that I think put the story back in the forefront, back on the front burner of the American consciousness, and ever since it's been an inexorable journey towards this trial and conviction of R. Kelly. So welcome to the show, folks. Dream, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's my honor.
Dream, I mean, to my mind, I've never seen anything like this, certainly in the music business. I think it's unprecedented. It's a huge,
agreed,
huge event, but this is historic, right?
I am still gobsmacked. I really couldn't believe the verdict that came down. I mean, when we set about, you know, picking up where, you know, Jim had these sensational headlines in BuzzFeed and The New Yorker about, you know, this evidence that his behavior had become more egregious, that it had escalated, in fact. And so when I'm asked to do this in 2018, I have no expectation around outcome. This is, you know, R. Kelly, who hasn't really had a hit in a decade. He's a 50-year-old singer. A new generation kind of has an idea that he's creepy and gross. But, you know, I didn't expect this to be what it was. And I'm not, this isn't like false modesty. I hope that it would move the needle and it would support the reporting that Jim had done in support of these women who, you know, kept coming forward and reaching out to him and finding him. When I got Sparkle to agree to come on camera, I knew I might have something really special, but I didn't think it would lead to, if it aired January, the first weekend in January, I didn't think it would lead to charges being filed in February. So everything about this has been surprising to me. Everything.
You know, it was shocking to me, Dream, when I got a call from an agent from Homeland Security Investigations. Yeah. and he said, and this is a week or two after Surviving R. Kelly aired, and they were spreading out across the country, a task force of 24 investigators. There's nobody in my book that they didn't interview. I mean, the government took this seriously. You and I had a conversation that in some ways broke my heart, but in other ways reshaped my thinking about the difference between print journalism and your medium, which is storytelling on film or video, right?
Right.
You know, you said we are post-textual. And this is a phrase I've heard in the English and Creative Writing Department in Columbia.
You know,
but the way I squared it, Dream, is for so many years I sat in small rooms at the Sun-Times conference rooms, right? You know, coffee shops with these women who did this incredible brave thing of trusting me to tell their stories of sexual abuse. This me, this fat white rock critic, you know? And then suddenly you brought them. I count 12 total victims in your work. You know, they were in your living room. And for years, for decades, dismissed as liars, opportunists, looking for media. And now we met them. You enabled everybody to meet them the way I had. And there was an undeniable power in that.
Yeah, no, they were everyday Black girls who didn't have an agenda. So many of them were dealing with trauma and abuse that was a decade old, sometimes two decades old. I think about Lisa. I think, of course, there were recent victims. But I think about, you know, I think about Geronda, you know, I think yeah. about, you know, Tarana during the height of kind of the Me Too moment and her being invited to help drop the ball in Times Square.
Me Too movement, Tarana Burke. Oh,
thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
We have this awesome tradition here in Times Square.
People- and she brought Geronda Pace down to Times Square with her as a reminder that Me Too had basically become a conversation about white women.
Right.
That, you know, here she was, this founder who was a Black woman and one of the most egregious, he's right up there with Epstein, abusers, was not even being looked at.
One of the honors of my life was to share a podium with her and Jamila Lemieux the day my book came out.
I love Jamila. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was great to see everyone rallying around. You've got a lot of Black girl love, Jim. because, you know, you've just spent so much time, like you said, in these small cafes and listening to these stories patiently. And you and I have also, you know, shared the fact that, you know, trauma is messy, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
We're not the heroes in this. And sometimes the survivors are speaking to us and sometimes they're not. And, you know, sometimes the parents are mad at us and sometimes, you know, it's like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
this
I
is
know.
Not, we don't get pats on the back for this. You know, I do think about, you know, sitting down with them and they sat with me 4 hours because that's what cameras require, right? Is that they sit under these hot lights for hours and I didn't get to do the thing where I reached across a bistro table and held their hands. I had to often act like a detective or a prosecutor. I had to ask follow-up questions that said, you know, that asked things like, well, who did you tell immediately after that happened? Did you tell anyone? Can I have that person's number? I had to corroborate their stories. Right?
Yeah.
We had to have a transcript that could be read in open court.
Yeah.
The transcripts of my interviews had to be litigation proof. And so I wasn't able to talk to them as a fellow survivor, as a Black woman or a sister. I was all of those things. But in that moment, I had to like produce something that would make it to air, quite frankly. Yeah. And there were many times, I mean, up until the week before Surviving R. Kelly aired or the month before it aired, when they shut down our screening by having a gunman inside the theater, which we later found out was true. It wasn't just a threat. You know, there were questions about whether or not our show was going to air, you know? And I say all that to say that, you know, they did this work of like telling their stories again. And none of them had therapy, you know?
No, I didn't they talk got nothing, to, no.
Yep. I didn't talk to one person. We didn't have therapy on set while we did have lawyers, you know? I wanted therapists. I didn't get it. I fought and got my own a therapist for Dominique after we performed that kind of, I don't know if you call it a rescue, but her mom
intervention. You know,
going,
yeah.
Yeah. An intervention, her mom going into the hotel. We just filmed what her mother was already doing.
She gave me with a book bag, a wife beater, some shorts and some flip flops with some socks on and a backpack. And that's all she had. And we ran out of there like the master was coming for us.
It's okay. And Gabe said he loved you so much.
You can ride in here, but
no, I don't. She don't want that. No, tell them to put the camera over there.
Okay. But the point was, is that I, you know, talked to A Long Walk Home, Salamish and Scheherazade Tillit, the organization they run in Chicago, and asked them if they could help us with therapy around Dominique. She wasn't necessarily ready for it. Again, this isn't a pat on the back. This is just talking about how messy this work is, you know?
You know, there was a moment, Dream, where Tarana turned to me before we were doing that event at WNYC, and she said, "You get emails and texts all the time from other victims now, don't you?" And I was like, "Yeah." And she said, "You know, you can't answer them all. You can't, you know." And I just knew that that was her experience. I'm certain it was yours as well. You know, having told these difficult stories, there is so much pain and so much abuse out there. People now come to you.
It's true. And I, unlike Tarana, I don't have training in this, you know?
Neither do I.
You're deeply empathetic and you've made that space in your life. Even when it comes to the survivors who were in on our show, I got a note from Buna Murray that told me to stop being in contact with them off camera for fear of litigation again, you know? Yeah. I'm just talking about the limitations of having a documentary aired on a publicly traded company, which is what A&E is.
You know, but it took me 9 months of reporting and three different publications that passed on the cult story, Dream. You know, the one thing I will take credit for, and I'm going to give you credit as well, you know, not a single retraction, clarification, correction, or lawsuit in anything we ever did. I don't think there's a thing you can be prouder of as a journalist.
It's true. And to see those same stories that were told in your articles, that was told on camera for Surviving R. Kelly, retold in open court under oath, also something that I was proud of. I was proud of the survivors. To tell that story again, you know, there were no cameras in court. We don't know exactly how it went, but we know that, yeah, I mean, I was threatened with lawsuits. There are two women, they were in The Reckoning, which you finally agreed to be in the part two, which I was not the showrunner on. I was a passive EP, but
right. No, see, for the record, if you had asked me, I would have been in part one.
I know,
but it was instead, it was these producers who brought us Keeping Up with the Kardashians. You know, I mean, it was one thing to say yes to Dream Hampton. You ever ask me anything, I'm saying yes, Dream. All right. And I think it's vice versa. But I know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I had these the real world people, for God's sake.
I mean, listen, when they called me, you know, my agent said, Buna Murray wants to talk to you about Surviving R. Kelly for Lifetime. And I said, no, thank you. Like, didn't Lifetime just do that awful movie on Aaliyah? It was like, no, thank you. Yeah. You know, I just didn't take it seriously. And they said, no, they want to do a documentary. And then they went about like kind of auditioning me and asking me about my approach. And I was talking to them about a lot of macro and cultural stuff. And there was a certain point about after the seventh or eighth call, I was like, listen, if you're going to hire me, but I'm not giving you all of my ideas. And so they did. And I don't think they had ever seen any of my films. I'd been making independent films and working in, you know, different ways. And they just didn't have any idea who I was. And so, you know, it wasn't the smoothest thing. I had an archivist on the show. She told me that she's been on TV shows where everyone loved each other. They had baseball, softball teams, and the shows just flopped. She said, when there's tension in these on these shows, then they tend to be good. And I held on to that.
Wow.
Because it was really hard. Like on reality TV, what they do is they sunset people in the edit. And that's where films get made, is in the edit.
Yeah.
And so they had like kind of, you know, said goodbye. And I was like, what do you mean? I'm ready to go into post. And they're like, no, we have these story producers, you know, middle-aged women who'd worked on true crime. And I was like, okay, whatever. I was really upset about it. But then a month later, they had to call me back because they were just dealing with something that was a lot heavier than I think they had ever dealt with before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's no shade to them. But before that, they had done things like Bad Girls and other kinds of shows. I remember saying, you know, the women can't be in the hotels together at the same time necessarily. What you have to understand is that the way that he would make women who were meeting each other for the first time have sex on tape.
Yeah.
Like that these women were pitted against one another at every, they were pitted against their parents. Like that this isn't some big kumbaya moment. They can't be seeing each other in. It was just all so messy.
You brave, okay? Look at me. Look at me. You brave. You so brave. You so beautiful. This was God. You know that, right? You know that, right? Look at me. Look at me. You know that was God. You didn't even think I would come before you, did you?
When we return, more with filmmaker Dream Hampton. That's next on Sound Opinions.
Yo, turn my music up.
And we are back. Let's return to our conversation with Dream Hampton.
This was almost happening in broad daylight. Like, for 30 years, this was kind of a known thing, but it wasn't out there in a way that somebody could successfully prosecute him, or much less do a film about it, or write an article in a newspaper about it, because the network of enablers for R. Kelly from day one is one of the biggest obstacles, I think, for this story emerging, for the victims wanting to tell their tales. I think the not only his friends and advisors and management, but also we're talking about a record company that essentially covered up these activities. I think had full knowledge of it. It's emerging now and didn't do anything to stop it.
Dream, I think after you and me being persistent in telling this story, the only other reporter, I think, who's ever forwarded it was Jeff Edgers of the Washington Post. In May 2018, he did something I tried to do for 20 years and failed at. He got Clive Calder, the founder of Jive Records, on the record. Clive Calder was a South African gent who launches this label in the new wave era with a flock of seagulls in London, okay? And then goes on. I mean, Jive was the most powerful, richest money-making machine in the music industry throughout the 90s. Clive Calder reached at his home in the Cayman Islands, Jeff Edgers said, he finally asked the question I've been dying to ask. And Calder said, "I'm not a psychiatrist. This guy's a troubled guy." He sold Jive, by the way, for $2.7 billion in 2002. Clearly, we missed something, Calder said. And then Jeff got to Barry Weiss, who actually ran the label.
And
what Weiss said to him was, I quote again, "I was a record company putting out R. Kelly's records. That was all I knew. I wasn't involved in his criminal cases. We were a record company, for God's sake." This record company was named in the first lawsuit filed by 15-year-old Tiffany Hawkins, claiming damages of $10 million. She only got a crummy $250,000 at the end, right?
Well, she did, or Susan Loggins did.
Well, Susan Loggins got one-third of the $250,000. Right. And, you know, Dream, somebody sues you or me for $10,000, we're going to know about it. You get sued for $10 million, and you're running a record company, you know about it. Are we going to see these guys held accountable?
Yeah, no, beyond that, and I got Barry Weiss on the phone. I don't know if this is like a smear. He's not medically diagnosed, but colloquially, people talk about having Tourette's. He just kind of like yells out whatever's on his mind, right? And he's yelling at me like he wanted to hear the list of the people that I had on camera. I was like, I'm not telling you. Beat it. You know, are you going to come on camera or not? You continue to do business with him after this 2002 tape of him abusing a 14-year-old girl. Went viral on the streets and then became fodder in like culture. You know, there was no way to not know, even if he wasn't your artist. So they absolutely did know. They knew about your reporting. They knew about the tape. If I were playing the devil's advocate and I cared about corporations, which I don't, I guess you could say, and this is something that I wanted to ask Jay-Z. I wish he'd come on camera.
Oh, yeah.
Were there legal reasons? You know, once you fail to convict someone of a crime, they are not guilty. As the, you know, song that he and Jay made, right?
Yeah.
So therefore, can you even end a record contract? You know, these aren't, back to Barry Weiss's statement of I'm a record music guy. He's not dealing with 1940s Hollywood where you have like morality clauses, which still exist in some contracts in Hollywood. Mm. Those don't exist in the record industry, right? So And I would have liked that human moment, even if it is corporate. I would have liked to hear those reasons. You know, yeah. I know, knowing Jay, that they actually, you know, the tour, the
best of both worlds.
Mm. One and two, that they had a contract to go on this concert. So these are contractual relationships that you have to decide that you're going to break, and they cost millions of dollars to get out of them. So I would have even liked the nuts and bolts. It may have been stark to see that against all of these tears and trauma, but I would have liked to hear that. I wanted to talk. I don't need to name them. I don't think it's fair to. They weren't that powerful, but they were two women, and you know who they are, at Jive Records.
Yeah.
Who they were R. Kelly's girls. They were, he wouldn't leave Chicago. When he wanted to make some ridiculous opera like Trapped in the Closet,
yeah.
One of these women would fly out to Chicago and be on set. I had anecdotal evidence of her talking about seeing like very young girls sitting in R. Kelly's lap when she was on set. I didn't want to have a gotcha moment with any of these people. I just wanted them to reflect 20 years later. Mm-hmm. As grownups, you know, they were grownups then, but as truly as 50-year-olds, like, can you now be reflective about it? And the lack of that kind of reflection is maddening.
You know, that's a great point. And I think that 20 years, 30 years now, we're talking about when this first started bubbling up. Dream, talk about the cultural moment, because I think the culture has changed. I think one of the initial obstacles to reporting R. Kelly was transgressive behavior by a popular entertainer. Wow, is that a story? I mean, we go, you know, the history of, you know, weird relationships and sex, drugs, rock and roll, and it's supposed to be weird. And then, but that's changed. I think a lot changed even since the 2008 trial, where
I'm not sure that it's changed. I mean, Anthony
Kiedis. I'm saying just the awareness of those kind of things has changed. You
Anthony
know?
Kiedis, yes.
You know where I'm going with this, Jim?
I know where you're going.
Well, Anthony, it keeps happening.
I mean, our lists.
The Epsteins of the world are still out there. But the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter, those things kind of, there's a confluence of these things.
We don't have less killings by police so far in 2021 than we did in 2014. We don't have less killings of Black people by police or extrajudicially. Here we are in 2019 and 2020, and no, things haven't radically changed. You know, he still has support and supporters. Some of that is manufactured. I was going to say that there were these two women, their sisters, they appeared in The Reckoning, nurses in Arkansas, former employees of R. Kelly. And they talked in the part two documentary about producing all of this kind of false support online in the same way that
engineering,
like a Russian troll farm, you know?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. That when I went out, I took my cameras out to the Little Caesars Arena in Detroit. R. Kelly was doing a small show with Mr. Biggs and with Ron Isley. And I was able to just walk up to people and they defended him. It was a knee-jerk reaction. And that, you know, Jim has talked about this. There's a historical context to this and it hasn't gone anywhere. Of Black men being falsely accused of sexual crimes in particular. I mean, that's the history of lynching. It is in our near history. It was never reckoned with. And it's in our collective memories. And it's just instinctual to kind of rally around Black men. I look at people celebrating Bill Cosby coming home. That was painful for me.
Yeah. Cheering.
So I think that someone like Geronda and all of the women who sat for Jim and myself, that they feel encouraged by something like Me Too and Tarana and all these other sisters coming forward. But I don't know that there's been some cultural shift.
I'm as skeptical, if not worse, as Dream, Greg. The way I put it into context is this begins the year that Anita Hill testifies on Capitol Hill and is ignored, and a powerful abuser sits on the Supreme Court. And this comes to a crescendo. Thank you, Dream, and surviving R. Kelly, when Christine Blasey Ford sits on Capitol Hill and is ignored, and a powerful abuser sits on the Supreme Court. I mean, that is just unconscionable. So how much progress have we made? Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movements have started conversations that very much needed to be had. But man, I don't see the progress. I mean, do you, Dream? There has now been the first major conviction of the Me Too era where the victims were women of color. That's the two parts of the history. Number one, the biggest predator in the history of popular music is now convicted of charges that run deeper and broader than anybody before. And number two, we had 22 primarily black victims believed. Does that make a difference?
That's right. That's right. And also, what does justice look like? Which I've been thinking about for a long time. You know, I don't think that. And here I think Joan Morgan's terrific reporting in The Village Voice during the Mike Tyson trial. And, you know, Mike Tyson, of course, goes to jail for raping Desiree Washington. But what happens while he's in jail, you know? And Mike Tyson, unlike R. Kelly, who coerced false confessions, who had a very sophisticated operation that was deeply manipulative, I believe that Mike Tyson genuinely didn't understand what consent was, which is a larger conversation that we need to have, not amongst women, but men and boys, right? When he stood up in that Indiana courtroom and they said, didn't Desiree Washington say no multiple times? And he replied under oath, let the say no. That's my Mike Tyson impression. that sent him right to jail. He goes to jail. What happens? Mm-hmm. Spike Lee makes a sojourn to visit him in jail. Louis Farrakhan talks about his innocence. He has the support of the community. So jail has never been a place where one rehabilitates oneself. And most people who go to jail come out at some point. So I'm saying that to say, what would have really mattered in R. Kelly's life would have been a kind of peer intervention, you know? And I know that he didn't have peers around him. He only had people on his payroll. He doesn't have real friends. But, and this isn't a Black thing, you know? This is, you can go to any town and there's some 25-year-old at a prom. There's some, you know, 23-year-old parked outside of a high school.
Right.
This is rape culture. This is patriarchy.
What I'm hearing here is that this trial is somewhat of an anomaly. It's monstrous, it's gigantic, it's historic, but it's not going to change anything. Is that what the general
feeling is? No, I think that it will change. I think, well, I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, we wish it will, but who knows, right? I mean, it was a mountain that these women had to climb for 30 years, some of them. It finally got to, it's a struggle. And
let's stay focused without too much digression. I can point to two recent moments that are more evidence that things aren't going to change. One was Kanye West, you know, has this incredible, you know, production set that he spent millions on, I'm sure.
Middle of Soldier Field.
He invites Marilyn Manson, accused of sexual violence, DaBaby, who before his homophobic rant, his first crime at that Rolling Loud festival was, you know, trolling Meg the Stallion with the man who shot her. That was what he was there to do, was to bring Tory Lanez on stage, right?
Yeah.
So that wasn't incidental. That was a doubling down. That was a politic, you know? That was the backlash to Me Too.
Los Angeles Magazine, Steve Appleford, a journalist I've edited and respected with a, you know, what was it, 10,000-word apologia character reclamation article for Ryan Adams.
Yeah. And so the second, after Kanye parades out these men, then you have Drake, you know, who in his battle with Kanye, does something similar with DaBaby, plays basketball with Tory Lanez, and then samples R. Kelly. Of course, his producer came out with this kind of half-baked excuse around it, but this is a man who too has kind of been openly grooming young girls, right? And this isn't my story to write. This is another generation's story to write and to take on. But those are the two kind of recent stories that are very much in the genre, in the community, you know, another generation, but in the community in which I live and love, where, it makes me not feel hopeful.
We're left, Dream, someone who loves music as much as me and Greg. We're left with this music. And people ask me this question. I don't want to see those records burned in the public square. But in the same way that Charles Manson's music is available for sale on Apple and Amazon and to stream on Spotify, I like me some freak folk. There is no reason to listen to Charles Manson's music if you do not want to wallow in the evil that it represents. What now do we who love music? It is our life force. It's why you have had a career and me and Greg, what do we do with his music?
Well, it's not up to us, right? There was a slight dip in largely because of the heroic lift of the Mute R. Kelly, of those two women and the chapters that they were able to organize nationally.
But now it's back to 5 million streams a month.
Which is where he was, right, as an R&B, as a genre artist. And I mean that as in another time, this would be called race music. You know, he had one song that for some reason people like to play at their bar mitzvahs, Ignition. And he had an eighth grade graduation song, I believe I Can Fly.
Yes.
Those are his two crossover moments. I'm not someone who thinks that feeling on your booty is beyond the pale. I mean, I grew up listening to hip hop. I learned about sex from Prince and from Too Short, you know? But here's the thing. This is foundational. The patriarchy is not something that we get through pop culture, you know? Virgin culture is also wrapped up in this. We look at Afghanistan and bemoan the future of their women. But when you look at what the Taliban wants, it's not much different from what evangelicals want here in America, what the trad life movement wants.
That's true.
I'm not some innocent in this. You know, I don't think that Prince married Mai Tai after her being in his house as a teenager. And when she turned 18, I don't think that's when they began having sex. I don't think that there is there are all these innocent men and then there's R. Kelly being awful. Right. So I would like there to be a fund established, not just for his survivors who are across the gender spectrum, but for, you know, I would like to see funds created. I think that these women are going to need therapy for decades. And I'm thinking about restitution. Mm.
Well, I think somebody ought to go to the Cayman Islands and ask Mr. Calder to donate the money he made off of R. Kelly in particular. One could also
be our trip.
Off of Britney Spears and off of NSYNC.
That can be our trip, Jim.
Let's go. Let's go.
Let's go to the Cayman Islands.
Some coconut drinks with a little umbrella in it.
All right, we'll drink down some retired executive for restitution money. Yeah, that sounds like a good trip.
I've been thinking about you a lot lately. Like, when your professional life's mission, and that doesn't mean that you don't do other things, but R. Kelly has been a driving force in your life. And what do you do now that this case has been settled? Is that some void in your life? I think about Heat. You know, I think about Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, you know?
Now, Dream, I never smoked until this R. Kelly story. All right, 19 years ago. You know, I would like to quit smoking. I would like to not cover the Northern Illinois case. I'd like to never write about him again and not have to feel like I have to answer my phone at 11 o'clock on Thanksgiving morning or, 10:30 on New Year's Eve or because I just never didn't respond to a phone call or a text or an email when somebody said, I need to talk to you. And that moment I talked about with Tarana Burke earlier, it was, you know, it's too much for any one human being. You know, you, me, Tarana, I think it's too much for any one therapist or any one criminal investigator. There is so much pain out there in the world, and we can't tell all of these stories. This one damn near killed me, and I know it was the same for you.
No, it wasn't the same. I was not on this beat for 25 years. I took the assignment when it came to me in 2018. But no, this has been in so many ways your life's work. And so, yeah, I just,
oh, but only ever reluctantly is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was very happy to be working on the Lester Bangs book or the Flaming Lips book or Sound Opinions and everything. And then this would come and sometimes, 6 months between, sometimes a year, year and a half, 2 years. And then I just went back into that mode. I don't want to go to that mode again.
Yeah. You know, I think that we'll continue to think about this and call each other and make comments.
So you're saying we're not done, Dream?
Maybe not. I haven't accepted projects that look like this. And I see that you haven't either. Like, of course, I'm not going to take on Drake, for instance. I think about the writing of people like Jamila Lemieux and other people who have begun to think about what it is to see something kind of happening in plain sight again.
And there are other filmmakers and younger journalists. I encourage them all. and exactly. and any wisdom they ever want that they think they can get from me, I'm happy to give it to them.
That's right.
Dream, it's been an honor. We're having you on again very soon.
Well, thank you, Jim.
Dream was twisting my arm, Greg, that we were going to do a show about movie music because as a filmmaker, she is, you know, a lover of great music, more than keep pace with you and me and movies.
I knew about Dream Hampton long before she was making movies because of her music writing.
Yeah, she doesn't like to remind people.
You were an inspiration with that.
She's a filmmaker now.
Yeah. I was just thinking about Jim Jarmusch and Neil Young, and not the film about Neil Young, but Dead Man, the Johnny Depp film. Where,
yeah.
Like, Neil Young has this great, like, just guitar kind of, you know, it's amazing. But anyway, but let's do it.
Let's do that. Let us do that. We need the cleansing power of music, Dream Hampton.
I'm down.
After the break, we'll share our thoughts on new music from gothic blues artists Adia Victoria and UK rapper Little Sims. That's next on Sound Opinions.
I'm going back south, down to Carolina. I'm gonna plant myself under a magnolia. I'm gonna let that dirt do its work. I'm gonna plant myself under a magnolia. Magnolia, magnolia.
That is a little bit of Adia Victoria. The song is Magnolia Blues from her third album, A Southern Gothic. Fascinating story for this young woman, Greg. Grew up one of five kids in South Carolina in a hardcore committed Seventh-day Adventist family. Was inspired early on as a reader, reading Flannery O'Connor, reading the poems of Angela Davis, very much a Southerner, born and bred, but eventually left Georgia on her 21st birthday. A friend gave her her guitar, and her fascination with music was born. Big critical acclaim for her debut album in 2016 on Atlantic Records, Beyond the Bloodhounds. Second album followed. In between, there were some a French EP and a classic blues record. And now comes the much anticipated album, A Southern Gothic, produced by one of Greg Kot's all-time heroes, T-Bone Burnett, and featuring some impressive cameos, including Margot Price and Jason Isbell on this song, You Was Born to Die. We'll give this a spin and come back with our opinions about A Southern Gothic. It's Adia Victoria on Sound Opinions.
Some stream of yellow, some in black and brown. I got a black woman, she used to be in town. You made me love you, and you made me cry. You should remember that you was born to die.
That was You Was Born to Die from Adia Victoria and her third studio album. Boy, that song, You Made Me Love You, You Made Me Cry, You Should Remember, You Were Born to Die. If that's not a threat, I don't know what is. That's pretty darn ominous. And I love the fact that she is able to couch this fire, this menace inside these very swampy, mid-tempo type of songs. You're not quite, you know, thinking this is that threatening and that ominous until you pay closer attention to what she's saying in the lyrics. It's a blues-based scenario here. I love the fact that this record puts you in the South, where grew up. You feel that humidity in these songs. They're sort of taking their time as they're developing. Nothing's going too fast.
No. The kudzu is growing. Yeah. The ivy is spreading.
It's so humid, you don't want to move fast.
Right.
You know, you just kind of want to, you know, lay back a little bit. But at the same time, she's channeling the spirit. If you listen to some of the early Robert Johnson, Charlie Patton stuff, that stuff had some nastiness in it. There was violence in the air. And she's channeling some of that vibe here in these songs. My one quibble with this record is that not everything is up to the par of, you know, Troubled Mind or You Was Born to Die. These kind of tracks. Mean Hearted Woman. I mean, wow.
I got it in me to burst into flames. Let the whole world burn. Let the ashes rain.
She is so enraged at this guy who kicked her out on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
She sort of goes from mourning to stunned, you know, what just happened to me to, you know, I'm going to make you pay
for what you've done,
did to me, you know? But some of the other stuff falls into sort of a mood piece territory. It's not quite as great, but boy, the high points on this record are amazing.
Well, you just named six high points. That's pretty good for one album.
That's about half the record, yeah.
You know, look, I think, I'm born and bred in Jersey. I've lived in Chicago most of my life. I do not understand the South. I sometimes defer to our producer, Andrew Gill. When she is singing, "My blood is yours and yours is mine, I got you in my bones, no matter where I roam," she can't escape the South. There are things she loves about the South, and there are things she hates about the South. I'm going to make a left-field comparison, Greg. I learned more about the South and the difficulties of being an alternative thinking person. This album, I've learned more than any album since Southern Rock Opera by the great Drive-By Truckers, mm-hmm. a record you loved, a record I loved a long time ago now. Yeah. You know, there are other Souths. I suppose I always knew that, too, from R.E.M. But I think this is a woman coming forward and giving us this portrait of the South. See, I disagree with you about there being down spots. I think there are brief rest periods where
That's one way to look at it.
The wind is howling round and round, and please come down.
Well, you know, the beauty is everybody keeps saying a jazz singer doing this roots music, and her voice is absolutely gorgeous. I've seen some people giving T-Bone Burnett crap for this not being, a gritty enough record. I love this record. Now, granted, it might have been me. As in our conversation with Dream Hampton, I had a hell of a week last week, mm-hmm. and I needed this album
yeah.
as the oasis. It was the refreshing glass of sweet tea that was helping me get through, okay? I just love this record.
The kingdom's on fire, the blood of the young Messiah. I see sinners in a church, I see sinners in a church. Sometimes I might be introvert, there's a war inside. I hear battle cries, mothers burying sons, young boys playing with guns. The devil's a liar, fulfill your wildest desires. Now I don't want to be the one to doctor this, but if you can't feel pain, then you can't feel the opposite.
That's a track called Introvert from the new Lil Sims record, Sometimes I Might Be Introvert. Fourth studio album from this London-based singer of Nigerian descent. Teen actress, uploading mixtapes at the same time to SoundCloud and Bandcamp. Extremely prolific artist in waiting, as a teen. In 2019, things really started happening for Lil Sims. Landed a role in that Netflix show Toy Boy and then released the Gray Area album, which was a breakthrough. Nominated for a Mercury Prize. Got, you know, people like Kendrick Lamar and Gorillaz singing her praises, you know.
Yeah.
You can't do better than that. She is a rising star. And this is her fourth studio album. She's working with a guy that Sound Opinions listeners should know by now through our constant praise for the group Salt, the mystery
yeah.
group. So in Salt, Inflow is basically the mastermind. Everything revolves around Inflow and his production work, and he's working with a number of collaborators,
now
including Lil Sims.
We think he is. He would deny. he wants to remain masked.
It is a mystery group to the 10th degree, but Salt has produced a series of outstanding albums over the last couple of years, and Lil Sims has been a part of them. Now, Inflow is basically co-producing and co-writing everything with Sims on this new studio album. So let's play a track from it before we review it. We're going to play a track called Speed from Lil Sims. Sometimes I Might Be Introvert is the LP on Sound Opinions.
Influential is I shouldn't keep my skin. All the sink in my pen is what led me to win. Do my thing, then I dust. I don't linger for fun. Oh, you wish you could come. Wanna be my plus one. Give a fuck about your style or the latest of trends. If you knew what it took just to get out the ends. Wanna stay where I stay. No, you owe me some rent. Still running with ease. Marathon, not sprint. Again, you could tell I'm really good.
That is Speed by Little Sims from Sometimes I Might Be Introvert. Mr. Cott, at one point, Little Sims raps, "I think I need a standing ovation. Over 10 years in the game, I'm impatient." Yeah. Well, Little Sims, I'm giving you your standing ovation. I love this album, and I'm embarrassed, Mr. Cott, to say that I have been sleeping on Little Sims, despite the nods she has gotten from everyone from Gorillaz to, as you said, Salt. Obviously, I loved her contributions to Salt, but I didn't go back and listen to her earlier albums on her own. You know, 24 hours in a day, and I got 2 years. I wish I had like 8 or 10 and triple, 36 hours in a day. Yeah. I think this woman's energy, her humor, her anger, and also her passion are just absolutely undeniable. The ambiguities she captures, it's great that we're pairing her with Adia Victoria. Because in the same way that Adia is a love-hate relationship with the South, Little Sims has a love-hate relationship with many things, including love. "I would hate myself if I didn't at least try for that," she tells an errant lover on "I Love You, I Hate You." Mm-hmm. And anybody who's ever been in love knows every once in a while there's a little hate. She's talking about the decimation of her community, which is not much different from so many American cities, and segregation and redlining and two standards for white America and black America. "I'm directly affected. It does more than just bother me. It's the threat, you know, that's laid out." You know, she is raging. She is laughing. She is seducing. It's a full range of emotions. If I had any quibble, it's just that at 19 tracks, could have been pared down a little bit, this album. My deep-seated, near-lethal allergic aversion to musical theater. There are times when, she's building a track over an orchestral flourish, which apparently was a full orchestra, and James Bond themes and Marshall snare drums.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking, all right, that's a little bit of Hamilton I could do without.
Your pain threshold will determine if you survive. I'm amazed by it. Lying to myself, pretending I was never faced by it. Maybe because you're in my DNA, that's why.
I'm going to coin a phrase for this, which I think is the Saint Vincentization of a lot of otherwise cool hip-hop and indie rock right now. Let's bring in a little musical theater! And, it always leaves me cold. But Little Sims is so good, I forgive her that sin.
Well, thank you for forgiving her, Jim. It's very kind of you. I have to say, 19 tracks, 65 minutes, I got no problem with length. What I do have a problem with is those five interludes.
Oh, okay.
That, oh, my God. Emma Corrin, the actress, played Diana in The Crown.
"You see, I've seen many come and go in my lifetime. Those that last have given up, made sacrifices to be here. Do you have the willingness to do the same?"
That stuff is hallmark schmaltz to the, it is just to the nth degree, and it's awful. It takes away from a lot of the stuff that she's talking about in the record, because you're going, I can't believe that Little Sims, with this incredible acuity as a lyricist, the verbiage is just so brilliant on this record. And then you've got these interludes weighing it down. If you got rid of those, you'd have close to a masterpiece here. I still think it's a great record. Maybe I can punch out those interludes and not have to listen to them ever again, because I don't want
to. Well, I'm as anti-interlude as I am anti-musical theater.
I mean, they're really bad. But at the same time, Inflow's production, I don't have as big a problem with the orchestrations as you do. I do think they add something. I'm thinking about the range on this record, the orchestral power of that Introvert track, where she's kind of marching into the room and taking over and saying, "Here's what I am. I'm one day I'm wordless, the next I'm a wordsmith." Yeah. She's talking about the two selves, two parts of her, the private person and the public person, and she's reconciling those two things. And this record is a lot about yin and yang. It's about conflict. It's about this whole idea of, you know, despite the struggles within her own family, despite the struggles mm-hmm. with herself, she talks about, you know, I love you, I hate you. That's a song about her relationship with her dad in part.
Yeah, yeah.
There's another song where she's mentioning the fact that her older brother was jailed. She's talking a lot about black women in England, you know, against the patriarchy and, mm-hmm. and just sort of rising above that. So there's a lot of struggle here with these contrasts in her life. And the music is as broad-ranging as that mission statement. I mean, I love that track, Fear No Man. I mean, yeah. That could have been Fela Kuti. That could have been an Afrobeat track. I mean, that's really ambitious stuff.
You're a typical rapper, I ain't got my neck froze. Still your favorite artist, couldn't even step close. Heard they want my crown, but I ain't never stressed though. Cause to your career, that would be detrimental. Come on.
So, brilliant lyricist. Her moment has arrived. Lil Sims has arrived.
I gave her a standing ovation.
Aware of this MC, she is here. What is it I'm meant to be? She asked on Standing Ovation. That's another line from that track.
Yeah.
And she's figuring it out pretty fast.
Do you have opinions on the latest from Adia Victoria and Lil Sims? Leave us a message on our website, soundopinions.org, with your opinions and why. Mr. Cott, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we're going to catch up with author Erin Osman and her great biography of Jason Molina, the man behind Songs Ohio and Magnolia Electric Company.
For more Sound Opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo, and our new intern, Mary Bernthal. Our social media consultant is Katie Cotton.